This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. What started as a research project for a Spokane Valley fire administrator has turned into a useful tool to evaluate the city's opioid use. The project compiled data from overdose calls and the number of times in which the drug Narcan was administered to reverse the effects of opioids. It also tells fire officials about where many of those calls originate. Rich Llewellyn is the Spokane Valley Fire Department's Division Chief of Emergency Medical Services. Several years ago, he was a paramedic who was often assigned to opioid overdose calls. In 2014, he noticed the number of calls seemed to sharply increase.
But I didn't have a good data-driven analysis or understanding of exactly where we were at with opiates in the Spokane Valley. What's happening here beyond my gut feeling or anyone else's gut feeling?
So Llewellyn adopted this as a research project for a class he was taking with the National Fire Academy. Using an electronic health record system developed by a company called ESO Solutions, he was able to gather data on overdose calls from the last quarter of 2016 through the first three quarters of 2017.
In 1 year, we administered Narcan to 88 separate patients. Some patients got Narcan on more than one occasion.
The total was 129 doses. Sometimes it took more than one dose during a single visit to revive a patient. A few people were seen multiple times throughout the year.
Kind of validated my thoughts that we were giving a lot of Narcan, but I don't know really where it was at relative to years before because we didn't have a really great system for finding that out.
Those figures give Llewellyn a baseline to which future years can be compared. For example, this year, he says, the department has administered about 19% more Narcan than the year before. One of the highest usage areas is in the north-central part of Spokane Valley, not far from the doors of Station 8, where Captain Sean Barrett is based. Barrett takes us on a ride along. In between going to medical calls, he tells us where medical technicians respond most often for opioid overdoses.
This is where we're going right now, for example, is Crossland Studio, so that's a transition housing area. So we see it in those areas, maybe see it in pockets where we have hotels, motels that are kind of lower socioeconomic.
It's an area with a highly transient population. Barrett says not only are paramedics going to more opioid calls, they're seeing a change in the types of opioids people are taking.
When I first came on, it was very rare to hear about a heroin overdose. I wasn't going to too many of those. So the people that we were administering Narcan to were most associated with hydrocodone, oxycodone, and those type of responses. Then it kind of transitioned into the heroin overdose, and now we're seeing a little bit of the fentanyl overdose, and I understand, you know, in Canada and the eastern side of the United States, they're seeing car fentanyl overdoses.
That, he says, is much more powerful than even fentanyl, considered one of the most toxic substances. So what to do with these new figures? Rich Llewellyn has an opioid prevention campaign in mind.
We're going to work with the Spokane Regional Health District in order to develop some co-branded information on opiate awareness, opiate signs and symptoms, where to get help, what to watch for in others, and how to address those problems.
The goal is to share that information with the people in some of the areas where overdose call volumes are highest, and he hopes to reduce the number of calls needed to revive opioid drug users. One step forward this week toward a new silicon smelter just south of Newport in northeastern Washington. The State Department of Ecology has formally begun the process of evaluating the proposal by the Canadian firm PacWest Silicon. The company wants to take sand that it mines up in British Columbia, truck it across the border, and combine it with other ingredients and a whole lot of heat to turn it into silicon metal, up to 73,000 tons a year. The finished product would be sold to manufacturers that make goods such as solar panels. News about the smelter has been circulating in Newport and across the border in North Idaho for more than a year. But because the company hadn't submitted a proposal to regulators who must issue the necessary permits, there wasn't anything tangible for regulators to assess. Now, says ecology spokeswoman Brooke Beeler, there is a proposal and the beginning of a public process.
what we were doing is really trying to get our staff geared up, get all of our ducks in a row in order to be prepared enough to ask the public questions about this proposed project and get more information from the company so that we're putting out a project proposal that makes sense to people and they can ask the right sort of scoping questions for an environmental impact study.
The Department of Ecology has begun an initial 30-day public period. The agency will hold 4 public meetings, including 3 next week, Tuesday night in Spokane, Wednesday night in Newport, and Thursday night in Priest River, Idaho. The 4th will be an online webinar in about 2 weeks. The project has divided the community. There are those who think the proposed site is a terrible place for an industrial plant because of its potential for air pollution. And there are those who think its environmental dangers are overblown. They tout the potential economic benefits. The project has had its political ramifications. Smelter opponent Cheryl Miller is trying to unseat Ponderay County Commissioner Mike Maness. He's one of the elected officials who has been working with PacWest Silicon. Brooke Beeler says the public's intense interest in the plant has helped the agency get a head start in evaluating it.
Some key ideas are going to certainly be the air emissions, make sure that stormwater runoff is managed, that the water resource accesses a legal supply, and those are sort of the top ones for us, but it doesn't end there. We want to look at transportation impacts and anything else that might affect that nearby community.
And so, after a lot of anticipation and a lot of angst, people can now begin sharing their ideas and opinions.
We have a lot of opportunities for people to learn about the project and understand it. We've got a project webpage that has a new updated project description with a little bit more detail. We've got a listserv for folks to sign up and get regular updates, and we're definitely interested in hearing from people, whether it's verbal comments in person, whether it's by email or submitting a comment online. They'll all be weighted equally, and we want to hear from folks.
Next week, we hope to bring you some of the comments from one or two of the public meetings. In less than 2 months, voters around the country will go back to the polls to select U.S. senators and House members, state legislative and local officials, and a variety of ballot measures. Over the next several weeks, Spokane Public Radio will provide information on candidates and issues. We start in Spokane County and focus on one of the least visible races, that for a slot on the Superior Court bench. In February, Shelley Zamblin was a municipal court judge in the city of Spokane when Governor Jay Inslee picked her to fill a vacant Superior Court seat. And now state law requires her to run for the seat to keep it passed this year. In February, Shelley Zamblin was a municipal court judge in the city of Spokane when Governor Jay Inslee picked her to fill a vacant Superior Court seat. State law requires her now to run for the seat to keep it beyond this year. Municipal and district courts are considered courts of limited jurisdiction, traffic tickets, misdemeanors, simple infractions. Superior Court handles the more serious cases, and so it was no surprise that when we met Zamblin, she had a big white binder with her. She was sitting at a table on the patio of a coffee shop a few blocks from the courthouse. Inside the binder were the papers for the cases she would consider later that afternoon.
This is a very small Friday civil motion binder. I was talking to another judge the other day, and they had a stack of paper about that thick, so roughly 5 inches thick, and that was for one motion. It is mind-blowing in a sense how much and how varied it is. There's Involuntary Treatment Act hearings, juvenile, criminal felonies, family law, commercial disputes, unlawful detainers. I sit on that docket.
In other words, she does a lot of reading. Often she'll take binders home on the weekend to prepare for Monday cases.
And it's funny because I'm not really a morning person, and I gave up coffee. And as you can see from my iced coffee here, I'm back to drinking it. And I'm usually at work around 7:30, if not before. And I usually work through lunch and stay late. So it's definitely voluminous.
Zamblin touts her experience as a judge as a reason why she believes voters should choose her over her opponent.
Judicial experience is very helpful. Temperament, because you're dealing with people you know, not at their best as a general rule. You know, if it's a criminal situation, you know, their life and liberty is at peril. If it's a family law situation, it's a highly emotionally charged situation for everybody involved.
And she says that's where doing the job every day as opposed to fill-in work on the bench makes her the better candidate. Shelley Zambelin's opponent is attorney Dennis Cronin. As we sat in his conference room, I noticed over his shoulder a photo of the late Carl Maxey. He was the longtime attorney and civil rights activist whom Cronin calls his legal mentor.
Carl Maxey took me out of legal services back in the 80s, around 86 or so, if I get the date right about then, when I was a poverty lawyer. And from there, for the next 15 years, I worked for Carl Maxey, became his partner, became his personal attorney, became the firm's attorney, went all over Washington.
Trying cases in different counties, different jurisdictions.
Carl was an amazing man, an amazing influence. And I am who I am as a lawyer because of him.
Cronin now runs a solo practice near the courthouse. When we meet, he points to a chart that lists the heavy workload of the Superior Court, more than 28,000 cases filed during the first 5 months of this year. He says the court needs to address some of the structural issues that lead to such a large number of people being incarcerated.
There are families that are being traumatized over in that court. More so than when they come in. I mean, they come in under trauma. The families in one way or another are having serious problems. That's why they're in court. The system over there is just making the trauma worse. It shouldn't take 2 years for a family that's restructuring to get a divorce. It shouldn't cost $50,000 for a family that's restructuring to get a divorce.
Cronin believes the Superior Court needs to carry out a review and find ways to make it more efficient for people to move through the system.
There are alternative ways to resolve disputes other than the traditional manner of hiring lawyers, going to court, spending a lot of money for over a year, going through motions and practice, and then you can do it quicker, you can do it cheaper, you can do it in a more dignified manner, such as mediation, facilitative mediation, or an arbitration.
That's an area where he says he's very experienced. Dennis Cronin is one of the two candidates for a seat on the Spokane County Superior Court bench. He's running against a sitting judge, Shelley Zambelin. And now we go from the Superior Court judge's race to the office that administers that court. The Spokane County Clerk's Office is the keeper of the papers related to the Superior Court system. The clerk is Tim Fitzgerald. He's a Republican who was appointed in 2014 after a long career in the Marine Corps. He was reelected later that year.
What we do is pretty straightforward. We do the day-to-day business of the county. So I run my office as executive-level management. There's no politics in the office. It's executive-level management, executive-level leadership. It's people, it's processes, it's budgets, it's relationships and strategic thinking. And that's what I do. That's what I bring to the table. My last tour before I retired after 30 years in the Marine Corps was one of my four combat tours. I was a chief of staff of all NATO forces in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. Relationships, strategic thinking. That's what I bring to the office, the ability to look out in the future, see where the office has to go. I execute the law. I don't make the law. That's what your legislators do. I don't rule on the law. That's what your judicial branch does.
Fitzgerald says he's improving the customer service function of the office.
When I took over, people said, Tim, you know, money order, cashier's check, cash, just got no credit cards. I went to work on that. And now in the courthouse, you can do debit and credit card in the courthouse. Additionally, I talked to the court about allowing offenders to use debit cards because most of them have debit cards, and that's how people pay with stuff. And they're coming in saying, I have to walk all the way down to a bank, pay extra money to get a cashier's check, and then come back and pay off my fine. It just seems like a harsh way of doing business. I said, you are right.
Fitzgerald says his office is also modernizing its technology by moving to a new case management system.
The last time the state did this was back in the early 1980s. When he went to a system called SCOMIS, which is what we currently use today. That's the Superior Court Operations Management Information System. That's how you document all your legal files on a statewide system electronically. And so now we're changing that system. And it's one of the largest computer programming changes that Spokane has made probably 25 some odd years, and we do that this November. So again, with my executive level management, my understanding of people, processes, budgets, my relationships that I have built, this is critical.
Challenging Tim Fitzgerald for Spokane County Clerk is Democrat Michael Kirk. He's a native of the Low Country of South Carolina and the father of a toddler daughter, whom you can hear playing in the background.
Grew up in a family with a strong military heritage, a strong faith tradition, and went into ministry towards the end of my time in high school and on through college and thereafter. And my family, we moved out here to Spokane just about 3 years ago to settle down and start our family.
Kirk says his qualifications to be a county clerk were developed not in the military, as were Tim Fitzgerald's, but in a religious setting.
I was trained in people-oriented management, servant leadership, being there for the people that work for you, and supportive, because it's in that sort of environment that people are comfortable to bring forward their mistakes and their questions, which prevent those from becoming the kind of catastrophes that can come about when a legal system isn't able to retrieve the documents and evidence that it needs. I was also, during my years in ministry, trained as a canon law case assistant. So I worked directly with people in completing their legal documents, determining which sort of case they had and needed to file, and making sure that each detail of it thereof was perfect before it was sent off, so that we're not wasting months of these people's lives and we're not wasting the time of the judges.
Kirk says for many, the clerk's office is a place of trauma, and he promises to create a warm and welcoming environment for its customers. He says he will also be assertive in standing up for the interests of the office.
You know, the clerk's office right now is in the middle of a technological renovation, and when the commissioners who appointed Colonel Fitzgerald 4 years ago told him to cut budget, he just did, even though there's need for new equipment. And there's need to maintain experience, which costs a pay raise, which costs requisitions. It's just simply not a time to be cutting budget. Prosecutor Haskell and Sheriff Knezovich both stood up to the commissioners and said no, but Tim didn't. And that's something that, from my experience in ministry, when there are higher principles involved, sometimes you plant your feet, you stare the pastor in the eye, and you say you're wrong. And that's something that I'm prepared to do.
Michael Kirk is a Democrat. He's challenging Republican County Clerk Tim Fitzgerald. You can hear our full interviews with the candidates at our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org. Click on the Regional News tab and then on 2018 election. One program note, next Monday we'll have a special one-hour Inland Journal. We'll review the Spokane City school and library bond issues. We'll talk with Library Director Andrew Chance about a $77 million proposal to build new libraries and renovate several others. And we'll talk with Spokane school officials about a $495 million measure to build three new middle schools, to renovate several other schools, and build a new high school sports stadium, as well as many other projects. We'll take your comments and questions next Monday at 6 p.m. on both KPBX and KSFC. North Cascades National Park turns 50 years old next month. It took some skillful political compromise in the 1960s to establish the new park and the adjacent Ross Lake and Lake Chelan National Recreation Areas. The next 50 years for the park complex may need more skillful stewardship, as correspondent Tom Bonsi reports.
North Cascades National Park and Redwood National Park were both signed into being on the same day by President Lyndon Johnson in October 1968. The North Cascades Park and its friends are celebrating the Big 5-0 from August to October. There was Cascades karaoke at the Park Visitor Center last month, artists in residence, a history town hall. A mountain climber is trying to scale 50 peaks in the park for the 50th anniversary. Coming up, the park gets more love at a harvest festival in Stehekin and a mid-October party in Seattle. Emlyn Johnson and Dan Ketter co-direct the American Wild Ensemble, which you would have heard doing back porch sing-alongs and campground concerts.
It is a very hard birthday to get your head around.
Since it's obviously not the 50th
birthday of the natural features in the park. I think it really is something worth celebrating. It's the 50th anniversary of the group of people that decided that the park was something that they should be celebrating. And that was definitely a sense that we got there.
About those people, they included a political legend, U.S. Senator Scoop Jackson. The first paid environmental lobbyist in the U.S. got his start pushing for North Cascades National Park. Author Lauren Danner says activism in the 1950s and 60s to establish a national park jump-started the modern environmental movement in the Pacific Northwest.
It's always in the national parks you should see that you don't know about. And it is hugely important in what its creation meant for the modern environmental movement, because it helped that movement get off the ground.
Danner wrote in a recently published park history titled Crown Jewel Wilderness about how logging, tourism, bureaucratic, and conservation interests were reconciled.
Well, what happened in the North Cascades was, what I think, a masterful political compromise. No one was totally satisfied. People today still want Mutt Baker in the park, right? Mm-hmm. Some people want Steak it out of the park. But everyone got a little of something what they wanted. And when you look at a map, that is what you see, because it looks like a patchwork quilt.
A mishmash of dotted lines and color shades with different levels of protection. There are two pieces of true national park, split by a national recreation area with three dams, bracketed by another national recreation area, next to national forest wilderness and an international border. It's a complex complex, says current park superintendent Karen Taylor Goodrich. She says the next 50 years might be dominated by facets of the same issue she's wrestled with for the past five since she took over as superintendent.
First and foremost, it's really adaptation.
To a warming climate and changing population, Taylor Goodrich says melting of the park's many glaciers affects water supply. Plus, there are more wildfires burning more broadly. She may need to bring in seasonal rangers earlier for a longer visitor season. The park is normally snowbound for half the year.
We have, you know, different maintenance challenges with more spring flooding. So we're having to be more reactive right now as we adapt, but in a number of different ways.
This year, the three units of the North Cascades National Park Complex could hit 1 million total visitors for the first time. The park does not charge an entrance fee, unlike other Northwest national parks like Mount Rainier and Crater Lake. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. If you miss the radio version, you can go to SpokanePublicRadio.org and listen online for entire programs or individual stories. We thank you for listening and providing your financial support. I'm Doug Nadvornik.